You know, when we think of a genius idea, we usually picture someone like standing in front of a giant whiteboard.
Yeah, connecting all the dots of a perfectly laid out puzzle.
Exactly. You find that one missing piece, you snap it into place, and boom, massive breakthrough. It's a very comforting image.
It really is. It makes the path to innovation look like this straight, logical line. You know, you identify a gap and you fill it.
Right. But if you look at the reality of how breakthroughs actually happen, that puzzle analogy is completely backwards.
Totally backwards.
In fact, if you're just looking for the obvious missing piece, you're playing one of the most dangerous games in science, or, I mean, in business for that matter.
Without a doubt.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, our mission is to explore the anatomy of a great idea. We're drawing from this fascinating document from a researcher at the National University of Singapore.
And it really breaks down how scientists, innovators, and strategists actually come up with the right questions to ask.
Yeah, and whether you're prepping for a boardroom strategy meeting later today, or you just want to be a sharper, more effective thinker, the biggest takeaway here is that not all questions are created equal.
Not at all.
Sometimes asking the most logical, obvious question is literally the riskiest thing you can do.
It's a trap, honestly.
Okay, let's unpack this. Before we get into the different types of questions, there's a core distinction we need to establish. Innovators are usually doing one of two things, right?
Right. They're either defining a question or they are defining an objective.
So a question is about seeking knowledge. Like, how does this specific virus replicate inside a human cell?
Exactly. Whereas an objective is about creating a tangible solution, like we need to build a new diagnostic tool for this virus.
Right, but the fascinating part is that whether you're asking a question or setting an objective, how we categorize the ambition behind it that remains the same.
Yeah, the framework still applies.
And the first category of ambition is the obvious question.
The obvious question. And, you know, in this framework, obvious doesn't mean easy.
Right, that's an important distinction.
It means it's a logical extension of prior research. It addresses a widely acknowledged gap in a field.
So you look at what's known, you see what's missing, and you just aim to fill that specific hole.
That's the textbook definition. It's the next sequential step on the staircase.
Wait, I have to push back on that being a bad thing, though, because, I mean, progress is built on filling gaps, right?
Sure.
If there's a hole in our understanding of a disease or a gap in the market for a software, filling it makes complete sense.
It makes complete sense to the person looking at the gap, which is exactly why it's so seductive.
Oh, interesting.
You feel like you're doing this necessary work. But obvious questions have massive, massive drawbacks.
Okay, like what?
Well, first, the outcomes are highly predictable. You're very unlikely to yield a result that fundamentally changes the paradigm.
Because you already kind of know what you're looking for.
Right. Second, because it's usually incredibly specialized, wider public interest is pretty low. But the third, and really the most dangerous drawback, is the competition.
Ah, because if the gap is obvious to you.
It's obvious to every single competitor looking at the same data.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You're using readily accessible information. So the risk of being beaten by a competing lab or a rival startup is astronomical,
Right.
especially in basic curiosity-driven research, because it often only has a single objective answer. It's a winner-takes-all scenario.
So if someone else gets there a day before you, their answer isn't just better, it renders your entire project completely obsolete.
You don't get a silver medal, you just lose.
Wow. And there's a brutal case study in our sources about this, right? With the discovery of leptin.
Oh, yeah, this is a classic example. So for years, scientists knew there was some kind of circulating factor missing in a specific strain of obese mice.
Right.
They knew it regulated body weight, but nobody actually knew what the physical molecule was.
Like the ultimate missing puzzle piece.
Exactly. And because it was an obvious, recognized gap, with only one single answer identifying that specific hormone, every major lab was racing for it.
Just a mad dash.
Yeah. And Jeffrey Friedman's research group at Rockefeller, they finally identified the satiety hormone, leptin. They won the race.
Okay, but what about everyone else?
Every other lab that had poured, you know, years of funding, late nights, entire careers into that exact same obvious question, they simply lost out.
That is harsh.
There's zero reward for second place when the question only has one answer.
Wow. So if the obvious route is basically a trap, it feels like the only way out is to stop looking for missing puzzle pieces and start questioning if you're even building the right puzzle.
That is the necessary pivot. You have to elevate the ambition from an obvious question to a fundamental one.
a fundamental question.
Yeah. So if obvious questions look for missing facts, fundamental questions examine the validity of widely held assumptions.
They challenge the very foundation of what everyone else in your industry is taking for granted. Here's where it gets really interesting. The sources highlight this 2016 study published in the journal Cell about fever, fasting, and infections.
A great example.
Because the widely held assumption has always been that a fever and a loss of appetite are just your body's way of fighting off a bacterial infection.
Right, the old starve a fever adage.
Exactly. So what did these researchers do differently?
Well, they stopped trying to find the next sequential fact and instead asked a fundamental question. Is that old assumption actually true?
Like, is starving a fever actually helping?
Right. And if so, what is the mechanical reason we lose our appetite when we get sick in the first place?
And the answer wasn't just a simple yes or no.
No. It turns out the protective effect of fasting depends entirely on the type of infection you have.
Okay, break that down for us.
So if you have a bacterial infection, fasting is beneficial.
Okay.
Bacterial toxins cause your cells to produce this sort of chemical exhaust, which damages your neurons.
Oh.
But fasting lowers your blood glucose and increases ketone metabolism. And that acts as a shield, protecting your nerves from that exhaust.
Okay, so fasting protects you from a bacterial infection. But what happens if that infection is viral instead?
The exact same fasting response becomes deadly.
Wait.
Deadly.
Yeah. During a viral infection, the virus hijacks your cellular factories to produce viral proteins.
Right.
And those factories start overheating under the stress.
Right.
To survive that specific stress, your cells desperately need nutritional supplementation. They need glucose.
Wow. So feed a cold, starve a fever is actually this incredibly complex metabolic switch.
It really is.
But let's apply this back to the strategy of asking questions.
Yeah.
Why is challenging this assumption a safer bet than racing to find, you know, the leptin hormone?
Because of the guaranteed return on investment.
How so?
With a fundamental question, even if your research just proves that the old assumption was 100% correct,
yeah,
you still have a highly valuable publishable finding.
Oh, I see.
Because rigorously proving a foundational mechanic is interesting to a broad audience.
Mm.
You aren't going to fail just because you didn't find something completely novel.
That makes a lot of sense.
Plus, because you're exploring foundational machinery rather than hunting for a single missing fact, the door is wide open for unexpected side discoveries.
You're exploring the whole room, not just looking in one specific drawer.
Exactly.
So we've gone from filling obvious gaps to challenging fundamental assumptions. But there's a tier above that, right?
Oh, definitely.
What happens when you stop asking about what exists and start asking about what is actually possible?
That's when you move into the realm of the visionary or the what-if question.
The what-if question.
Yeah, these questions start with a vision to achieve something currently impossible, but potentially game-changing. There are also tech-driven questions, which are similar, innovating new technology to measure things that were previously impossible.
Right, though the text does warn that tech-driven questions can be tough for students without massive resources because of time constraints.
True, but the what-if question is where things get really expansive.
And Noubar Afeyan, the co-founder of Moderna and CEO of Flagship Pioneering, is a perfect example of this.
A master at it.
In 2010, Afeyan and his colleagues didn't look at the pharmaceutical market and ask, what's an obvious gap in vaccine production?
Right. They didn't care about the obvious gaps.
They asked a massive, broad question. Could mRNA be a drug?
Yeah. They weren't even setting out to make vaccines specifically. They were asking if this fundamental biological messenger could be utilized as a universal therapeutic tool.
Which is huge.
It is. Asking a question that broad is a masterclass in strategic positioning.
Because it changes the playing field.
Completely. Think about the landscape back then. Traditional pharma companies were engaged in this fierce, bloody competition targeting specific diseases with obvious approaches.
Fighting over those puzzle pieces.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But Moderna stepped entirely out of that arena. By focusing on mRNA as a platform, they completely avoided the saturated market.
They stopped fighting for market share in an existing category and just invented a new category.
Yes. And even though that vision took over a decade to fully realize, obviously culminating in the COVID-19 vaccines, they weren't just sitting idle that whole time.
Right. The process itself was valuable.
Incredibly valuable. Pursuing a what-if vision produces incredible interim insights.
What kind of insights?
Well, along the way to their ultimate goal, Moderna filed countless patents and gained scientific knowledge that had its own standalone value.
Oh, wow.
They built an entire foundation of intellectual property while everyone else was busy fighting over single obvious facts.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it all sounds great in theory. You know, escape the obvious trap, challenge assumptions, dream up visionary questions.
Right.
But let's move from theory to practice for a second. If you're sitting at your desk right now trying to innovate, you can't just squeeze your eyes shut and wait for a lightning bolt of inspiration to strike.
No, ideas don't just materialize out of the ether.
So how do you actually do it?
Well, you need a solid conceptual understanding of your field to even spot the hidden assumptions or unmet needs.
Okay.
And one of the most reliable methods for generating these high-level questions is intentionally connecting completely disparate ideas.
Connecting things that shouldn't normally go together.
Exactly.
Like the case of neurosurgeon Harry Bulstrode.
Yes, perfect example.
He was looking at glioblastoma, which is this incredibly aggressive brain cancer with very low survival rates.
Very tough disease.
At the same time, the 2015 Zika virus epidemic was making headlines everywhere. And Zika generally causes mild symptoms in adults, but it's devastating to pregnancies.
Right, because it specifically targets and destroys developing neural progenitor cells in a baby's brain.
And Bulstrode had the conceptual knowledge to make a huge leap here.
He did. He recognized that aggressive glioblastoma cancer cells bear a striking resemblance to those developing neural progenitor cells.
So he connects these two totally unrelated horrors, a brain cancer and a virus, and asks a brilliant question.
Could we use the Zika virus to specifically target and kill glioblastoma cancer cells while sparing the normal, mature brain cells?
Just incredible. You take a mechanism from epidemiology and apply it directly to oncology.
It's brilliant. And we see another fantastic example of this contextual expansion with Guy Lutzber's work.
Oh, right, with the continuous glucose monitoring or CGM devices.
Yeah. Normally, if you wear a CGM, it's because you're diabetic or pre-diabetic.
Right. It's tracking your blood sugar to manage a diagnosed condition.
That is the obvious intended use case.
Mm.
But Lutzker and his colleagues expanded the context.
What did they ask?
They asked what would happen if they looked at CGM data from people who do not have diabetes.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. They trained a generative AI foundation model called Glueformer on over 10 million glucose measurements from completely healthy adults.
So they used a diagnostic tool meant for sick people on millions of healthy people.
Yes, to predict risk.
And did it work?
It worked incredibly well. The Glueformer model could identify individuals at an elevated risk for developing diabetes and cardiovascular mortality far more effectively than the traditional widely used blood tests.
So by taking a tool completely out of its obvious context, they created a preventative breakthrough.
Exactly. It's about ignoring the boundaries of how things are supposed to be used.
Which brings up a concept from the research called rule bending.
Rule bending, yes.
To uncover hidden assumptions, you really have to discount the constraints that everyone else is blindly honoring.
Yeah, the co-discoverer of the DNA structure, Francis Crick, he had a great quote about this. He said, "A theory should not attempt to explain all the facts because some of the facts are wrong."
That is so good.
Right. If you try to build a project that perfectly accommodates every single established rule in your field, you will inevitably end up with an obvious question.
You have to break something. And Noubar Afeyan applied this rule bending perfectly to gene therapy.
He really did. So the established constraint in the industry was that if you want to deliver genes into human cells, you use one of two specific viruses.
Right. But they both have serious baggage, right?
Major baggage. One carries a risk of mutating genes and potentially causing cancer. The other can trigger severe immune responses.
But the hidden assumption across the entire industry was that those were the only two delivery vehicles available.
Exactly. Everyone assumed the goal was simply to manage their risks. But Afeyan bent the rule.
He just threw out the assumption entirely.
He asked, "What if there are endemic viruses already naturally present in our cells that cause zero harm?"
Oh, wow.
Right. Could we hijack those as the perfect invisible vehicles for gene therapy? He just ignored the constraint that everyone else accepted as a permanent roadblock.
It's like realizing the only two delivery trucks you own have bad brakes, and instead of trying to fix the brakes, you just use the delivery truck that's already safely parked in the customer's driveway.
Yeah, it is a perfect analogy.
Okay, so you've done the work. You've connected disparate ideas, you've bent the rules, and you have this fundamental or visionary idea.
Right.
But having a wild idea isn't enough. How do you make sure it doesn't just crash and burn when it hits reality?
Well, as creativity expert Scott Birkin notes, creativity is actually a kind of work.
It's not just daydreaming.
No, it's deeply analytical work. And to that end, the research introduces this playbook by Michael Fischbach for idea optimization.
Idea optimization.
Yeah, it's a systematic way to refine your idea to increase its likelihood of success and maximize its impact.
Okay, so what's the playbook?
Fischbach outlines four specific ways to reduce the risk of your idea failing. Number one, design a project that succeeds no matter how the data turns out.
So, like, don't test just one candidate, test a whole panel of them in parallel.
Exactly. Number two, perform the critical go-no-go experiment immediately.
Right. Don't spend months refining the aesthetics. Build a clunky, ugly prototype on day one and see if the core mechanism works even a little bit.
Yep. Number three, fix one parameter and let the other float.
Okay, this one makes so much sense to me. It's like saying, I don't care how we get to New York, as long as we arrive.
Right.
You fix the goal, New York, but the method is floating. You win as long as you get there.
Exactly.
Contrast that with saying, we absolutely must take this experimental new high-speed train, I don't care what city it ends up in. There, you fix the method and the goal is floating.
Either way, you guarantee a form of success because you aren't rigidly locking down both the how and the where. You define what success looks like flexibly.
Love that. And what's the fourth method?
The fourth method is perhaps the most profound. Turn the problem on its head.
Turn it on its head. We have a great case study for this from a 2018 study by Hong and colleagues, right?
We do. They were trying to create a degrader drug.
Okay, remind me what a degrader drug is.
It's basically a two-sided molecular drug. One side grabs a very specific target protein, and the other side acts like a homing beacon.
A homing beacon for what?
For the cell's natural garbage disposal system. It calls it over to come and destroy that targeted protein.
Got it. So Huang's team designed a drug intended to degrade two very specific proteins.
But it failed. The drug couldn't induce the degradation of those two targets.
And an obvious research question would just end right there. The project failed. Back up the lab. Go home.
But they turned it on its head. Instead of trying to target specific proteins, they realized that almost all of these proteins use a core energy molecule.
Okay.
So they created what they called a promiscuous degrader.
A promiscuous degrader.
Yeah. They made a tag that would blindly stick to anything that used that energy molecule just to see what the cellular garbage disposal would actually eat.
Oh, wow. It's like a software company failing to sell a specialized program to two specific corporate clients. So they just release the code open source to see which industries organically adopt it.
That's exactly it. And by doing that, they identified 28 different proteins that could be degraded using this method alongside many that couldn't.
So their initial failure to hit two targets turned into a massive foundational success.
A huge success. It mapped out the degradability of 28 different proteins for the entire scientific community.
Because they flipped the script.
Exactly. But, you know, reducing risk is only half of Fischbach's equation.
What's the other half?
Impact.
This raises an important question.
Even if your idea succeeds, will it actually matter? Fischbach suggests a really harsh impact analysis. You have to ask two questions.
Okay.
One, how much will we actually learn from this? And two, how many people will genuinely care about the answer?
He points to CRISPR gene editing as the perfect example of this.
Yes, it scores perfectly on both metrics.
Because we learned an incomprehensible amount about genetic mechanics from it.
And literally every field from agriculture to human medicine cares deeply about applying it.
But what if your idea doesn't score well?
If your newly generated idea scores low on both of those questions, if it doesn't teach us much, and nobody really cares, Fischbach is ruthless.
What does he say?
You need to abandon it. Do not waste your time and resources on it.
Just drop it.
Drop it.
Which, you know, brings us to the ultimate modern dilemma discussed of our sources.
The AI question.
Yes. There are tools currently being developed, like Sakana.ai's AI scientist, that are literally designed to automate this entire pipeline.
It's wild to think about.
They can generate ideas, read the literature, formulate projects. So if AI can do all of this, if it can analyze the data, bend the rules, and spit out optimized, de-risked questions, why don't we just outsource this entire creative process to generative AI?
Just let the machines do the heavy lifting.
Exactly. Let them figure out what to study next.
It is a really compelling thought, especially when we view innovation merely as a means to an end.
Right, if it's just about getting the product out.
But the researchers rely on scholars like Botvinnik and Gershman to answer this. And they argue that deciding what problems to work on must fundamentally remain a human endeavor.
Why is that?
Because human understanding is the ultimate goal of science. We aren't doing this just to compile a massive database of facts on a hard drive.
Right.
We are doing this so that we, as humans, understand our universe better.
So if an AI generates the question, runs the test, and stores the answer on a server, humanity hasn't actually gained understanding.
Exactly. The machine knows, but we don't. The output of science isn't just data. It's the cognitive shift that happens inside the human mind when a new connection is made.
Wow. And the researcher concludes with a quote from a 1992 article by Jonathan Singer, and I think it captures the spirit of this entire deep dive perfectly.
It really does.
Singer wrote, "Nothing has ever given me as much gratification and sheer pleasure in science as having a first-rate idea."
It's the joy of discovery.
Oh.
Automating the generation of ideas robs us of the deepest satisfaction of intellectual work.
That genuine, hard-earned aha moment where things finally click into place.
Exactly. You don't want to outsource the best part of being a thinker.
Because the struggle to find the right question is what actually prepares your mind to understand the answer when you finally find it.
Beautifully said.
So, what does this all mean for you listening? We'll leave you with this final thought. Take a look at your own daily work, your own field of study, or your business.
Look closely.
What is the most boring, widely accepted, completely obvious protocol or assumption that you interact with every single day?
The thing you just take for granted.
Right. Ask yourself, what if that foundational fact is actually completely wrong?
Right.
How would you build a fundamental question to test it tomorrow?
Stop looking for the missing piece of the puzzle and start questioning who drew the picture on the box.
Until next time.